what's up, folks? It's Brian Nichols here from The Brian Nichols Show on a fun-filled episode of We Are Libertarians Daily. And for my contribution this week, you are going to be greeted with a phenomenal episode of The Brian Nichols Show. It is the final episode for the 2018 season, and what a good one it was, folks. I was joined by Max Gulker. Max is an economist over at the American Institute for Economic Research, and we discussed his absolutely groundbreaking, earth-shattering article, The Inconvenient Truth About the Green New Deal, which obviously is in reference to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal push. So with that, I hope you enjoy today's episode. If you do, swing over to The Brian Nichols Show. We have interviews like this every single week. And with that, take a listen.
Brian Nichols, you're a great man with some great ideas, a great podcast.
Do you see why he's my favorite libertarian people?
Yes.
He's full of common sense and wisdom.
Brian Nichols here on The Brian Nichols Show.
Welcome to The Brian Nichols Show, your source for common sense politics on the We Are Libertarians Network.
Today I am joined by easily one of the best, Matt Kibbe. Welcome to The Brian Nichols Show.
Hey, Brian, it's good to be with you. By the way, let me take a step back and say I love what you're doing. I love the conversational style, and it's a combination of good fun and serious ideas. I love the fact that your show's doing what it does, and this is how we win the future.
The Brian Nichols Show is the fastest-growing liberty podcast that brings together people from all means of political thought as we seek to have meaningful conversations about the issues you care about.
There's so many things that we can do to make America freer and the world better and safer and more peaceful. Everybody has the responsibility of trying to help to do that. You know, what you're doing with your podcast is a perfect example of, you know, you're doing this as a labor of love and for the cause, and that is exactly what we have to have.
At The Brian Nichols Show, our goal is to leave the audience educated, enlightened, and informed. And now your host, Brian Nichols.
It's the most wonderful time of your week because you're joining us back here on The Brian Nichols Show. What's up, ladies and gents? Welcome back to another fun-filled episode of The Brian Nichols Show. I am your humble host, Brian Nichols, and today I'm joined by economist, writer, and senior research fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research, Max Gulker. Max's research often focuses on free markets and technology, including blockchain and cryptocurrencies, the sharing economy, and internet commerce. He's a frequent speaker at industry conferences, especially on blockchain technology. Max's research and writing also touch on other economic topics, including governance, competition, and small business. He holds a PhD in economics from Stanford University and a bachelor in economics from the University of Michigan. Prior to AIER, Max spent time in the private sector, consulting with large technology and financial firms on antitrust and other litigation. You can follow him over on Twitter at MaxGAIER. Max Gulker, welcome to The Brian Nichols Show.
Thank you very much, Brian. It is absolutely the most wonderful time of my week.
You know, it is the season to be jolly. And I'm a huge Christmas buff. I mean, I don't think there's anybody out there who isn't a big fan of Christmas. So anytime I get the excuse to be very, jubilant and joyful and boisterous, I'm going to take advantage of it because that's just who I am in real life. So, I mean, what better way to do that?
Well, you know, I was a Jewish kid in Indiana, so I have sort of an aspirational longing for Christmas.
Well, let me just say, we welcome you with open arms into the Christmas community.
Excellent.
And I would expect the same be true for the Jewish celebration of Hanukkah. I actually have a couple coworkers
who celebrate. Exactly. Christmas is a lot better, actually. So I'll take yours.
See, I wasn't going to say that because if I say that, then that's just not, tactful or tasteful.
Right. But I can say.
Okay.
It's all good.
Okay. So we'll let you say that. So with that, Matt, thank you so much for joining me today. So really, we've been excited to get this going for a conversation because, I mean, I've had your supervisor, the big man, not Santa, but Jeffrey Tucker on my show in the past, as well as your new coworker, Chloe Anagnos from Indianapolis as well. So to have you on the show, it's kind of like the trifecta, having you to conclude the AIER, the coalition there of you, Jeffrey, and Chloe. So with that, I like to give my guests the opportunity to first introduce themselves and really how you got to where you are in terms of not only professional career, but also in terms of your political ideology. So with that, Max Gulker, if you could, give us the elevator pitch bio. Who are you? What made you who you are, and what makes you tick?
All right. Wow, that is a mouthful there. So as I said, I think I've always been really lucky to be exposed to a lot of different viewpoints and sort of be forced to appreciate how people can come to different viewpoints. Like I said, I grew up in Indiana, was the child of parents who were New Yorkers, kind of post-hippie, but then moved to Indiana, very left-wing, but there I was, a kid in the heartland. And so very early on, I was kind of asking myself, well, I like all of these people, my parents and these other people, and they seem to all think that, you know, they have some point of view that is the right point of view. And it seemed like, well, none of these people are delusional or evil or anything like that. And so I ended up in college at the University of Michigan, like you said, and falling in love with economics, and ultimately found myself getting a PhD. Was lucky enough to be at Stanford. And, you know, I was exposed, I think, to a pretty different variety of economics than especially a lot of people, you know, broadly in the libertarian camp, although mine was probably much more the mainstream. I was probably at the place where they invented the mainstream, actually. you know, I ended up, you know, going in there thinking I'm going to be this big professor with this body of work with my name on it and all these things, and not really knowing what that was. And academic research, at least in that environment, ended up really not being my cup of tea, at least at that point. The sort of do something amazing and groundbreaking, but you don't have to talk to anybody and kind of come sort of ask us if you need any help, that type of thing, wasn't sort of the right way for me to work. And I ended up in the private sector in New York, working on mostly expert testimony for economists in big litigation, both financial, antitrust, intellectual property. Had the good fortune maybe to start a job working on financial litigation in January 2008. So saw a lot of interesting stuff there. And ultimately, I got to the point, it must have been 2014, it was about 4 years ago, where I had just kind of had it with both New York and with that kind of career, which was great for a while until it wasn't. And I ended up, you know, needing a big change, and found myself a couple of hours north of there in Western Massachusetts in Berkshire County, which is a beautiful place, Great Barrington, where we're located here at AIER, and actually kind of happened upon this place by accident, in a way. I, you know, sort of had friends up here and knew I was going to, thought I was going to kind of take a little sabbatical and plot my next move. And then lo and behold, here's this economic research institute in this town of 6,000 people that I love. And that was, you know, the first in a series of very fortunate steps. And just to backtrack for a second, in terms of, you know, I talked about being the child of kind of lefty parents. I would say they, you know, about equivalent to, you know, the kind of current Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party. I was always a little moderated from that, I think, just by being an Indiana kid and then my education in economics. But at the risk of getting myself in trouble with my audience and my bosses, until about 10 years ago, I would say I was a pretty reliably Democratic voter. And then I think I stepped back one day and I said, I'm not hearing anything from these people in terms of economics and policy that I like at all. I think I'm voting the way I am because I don't like some of the Republican positions on more social issues. And I ended up kind of losing interest in politics and then sort of going on this slow journey where ultimately, I think I was exposed to a couple of things that really put me on a path to kind of more libertarianism. One was sort of what we call heterodox economics, different approaches to economics than that sort of mainstream, what's called neoclassical economics I learned at Stanford. And, you know, that came in the form, one thing, of what's called complexity economics, which is, a different set of math and a different approach in looking at the economy as this sort of evolving system. And actually, really interestingly, similar to that is, I think, what a lot of libertarians know really well, which is which really kind of on an intuitive level kind of anticipated some of that complexity stuff that I said a long time ago, which has always really impressed me. And I started learning about Hayek and his thoughts on dispersed knowledge. And that to me was one of the most important insights I had ever found. And sort of together, those two things said to me that, okay, markets aren't necessarily perfect. Markets are essential. We need markets to take the almost incomprehensible amount of information about what people have, what people need, what people want, and turn that into what are we going to do to produce and consume and allocate resources, and that we're really at our own risk when we how can we change markets to do what we want to do? That doesn't mean we can't help people. The other thing I would just say I found, and then I'll stop talking your ear off, is I'll say it in a way that paraphrases our president here, Ed Stringham, that we can have governance without government, that we can have institutions, have things in our society that help coordinate our actions, help us work together, help take care of people who are struggling, that aren't this sort of top down, backed by the use of force, et cetera, kind of thing that we are kind of stuck in this assumption is what we need. And so I ended up here actually joining a little bit before Ed and Jeffrey, and our whole crew did, but it just came together really nicely. And I think, I try to bring, I think in some ways it's funny. I think in some ways I'm pretty radical in terms of what I think, ideally, the way we kind of govern ourselves in society should look. But I think I bring a slightly different perspective and hopefully, challenge some of the libertarian audience to say, maybe the motivation of the people on the other side isn't evil or isn't entirely misguided. Here are reasons, here are how we can do those things better without, sort of a centralized government. So it's really, I've been so fortunate to.
It's funny because last week I actually had John Chang from Otters Talking Politics out, and we concluded our conversation last week about that very topic, saying, the people that we're reaching out to who are more on the left progressive side of the political spectrum, it's not a matter that they approach things in a malicious, with an ill intent type of perspective. It's that they just have the similar goals that we do. It's the means that they have in mind as to get to that end goal. It's very different than what we have because ours is based on voluntary, individualistic determination and voluntarily working with other people versus being mandated by some overarching Leviathan government that's going to mandate people do certain things. So it's not a matter that they're evil or they're bad. It's just that in their minds, that's the best way to approach and obtain that end goal. And I think it's very important for us as libertarians or just folks within the greater liberty movement to approach our conversations with folks in that mindset of not trying to show why they're wrong, but to show them the different approach and help them get to that conclusion on their own. And I, anecdotally speaking, I've seen in my personal life, people that were acquaintances or very close friends who I've watched the wheels start to turn and saying, well, maybe there is a different way to get to the end game. Maybe, just because the government's not doing it doesn't mean that it can't be done. So that's actually a perfect segue into the main topic I wanted to discuss today, and that is the topic of climate change. Now, for those who have been listening to the Brian Nichols Show since the very beginning, this was actually one of the first topics that my show tackled, And I had two of my good lefty friends, Derek LeBaron and Paul Riley, on. And we had a very cordial discussion. They were on the more progressive, I don't want to say progressive, because I don't want to put ideology into this, but they're much more into the quote-unquote alarmist camp of saying anthropogenic climate change is happening and we need to do something about it. And by we, collective government. Whereas I have found myself, and I've definitely evolved on the topic over the years as more information has come out. I find myself, though, in the agnostic climate change, saying, I just don't think we have enough data. And I am not saying this as a climate scientist, and I hate it when people do the appeal to authority ad hom, where they say, well, or logical fallacy rather, that you can't have a conversation about this unless you're a climate scientist. It's like, no, as a rational, logical person, I can say I personally, anecdotally, don't believe that we have enough sample size of data points to then try and put that onto a scale of 4+ billion years. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't think that humans are having an impact. I think we most certainly are having an impact. I'm just saying, to what degree of impact are we having that is causing climate change to happen, number one. But number two, what is that relative to absolute certainty of changes that happened in the past? And I think we're basing a lot of our looking at the past on speculation. And it's educated speculation, it's educated guessing, and I respect that, but I just don't think that the amount of credence that we're putting on the data that we have nowadays is not as strong as it could be based on just our limited knowledge. Now, with that being said, I don't disagree for anybody on either side of the issue that there are things we can do to try and lower our impact as a human race on not only the greater environment, but also to try to do our part in lowering our impact on the climate. So with that, I'm a big proponent of eliminating subsidies for fossil fuels. I'm a big proponent in opening up the marketplace to allow innovations that would be alternatives for alternative energy sources to open up and expand and grow without having government try to pick winners and losers in the industry. So I think a lot of those in the more, I want to say skeptic, but just kind of, you know, I'm agnostic to it. In that camp, we're a little strawmanned in terms of what we actually believe. Now, you wrote a phenomenal article that was topical back last week covering Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's really big support for this Green New Deal. So to give the floor back to you, number one, I wanted you to, if you could, in a word or two, give a synopsis of what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal is, number one. But then number two, to the point of your article, the inconvenient truth about said Green New Deal.
Excellent. So let me kind of tell you the process that led me to writing that is, I was sitting there actually on a Saturday morning, must have been 2 weekends ago, and looking at sort of the Twitter feed of these folks who had advocated this policy called the job guarantee, which is basically the government gives everyone who wants a job at $15 an hour, and I had written a long report kind of arguing against that and was lucky enough to end up being able to write something in the Wall Street Journal about it. But I was kind of looking at the conversation they had been having in the last few weeks, and this Green New Deal kept popping up in these articles about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez storming Nancy Pelosi's office, leading these people. And I looked at an op-ed that some of those academics I was just talking to had written advocating for the Green New Deal, which, by the way, is a massive best estimate, although it's still very amorphous, kind of $700 billion to $1 trillion a year package of jobs and subsidies, et cetera, relating to clean energy. And the thought occurred to me, because the first thing that it said in this article is we can't let the Earth's temperature, total temperature increase, be above 1.5 degrees Celsius. So I don't know what we can't let means. We have a public discourse that has absolutely failed us, I think, in terms of climate change, in the sense that the debate we keep hearing over and over again is the world is going to end if we don't do everything we possibly can now versus it's not real. And because of that, I really, you know, and I'm an economist who writes about current policy issues, and even I had no idea, you know, if you look at these reports, what are the real consequences that they're talking about? And so, I'm super cool, and it was a Saturday, and I spent all my Saturday reading UN reports, and especially this one that came out in October. And, you know, let me just also first say that to me, the question of, you know, is it a hoax or is it happening? That sort of thing. I your point is well taken about the data. And to me, the sort of like extreme, is it a hoax question? I don't have an opinion on that. That's not really even interesting to me as an economist. I don't have any means with which to comment on that, but I thought, okay, what can I do? I can say, let me actually look at what's in this UN report. If that's true, what are our options? What are the costs and benefits of different things that we can do? I can certainly opine on that and educate myself on that. And so I started reading, and the takeaway really that I found, to summarize it, is, you know, taking everything at face value and leaving it at that, is that it's the consequences are severe, expensive, lots of problems. They're not, in all likelihood, existential. This is not, we have to change our entire way of living and economic system right now. It's much more, you know, I say incremental, meaning not small or not trivial, but the more we do, the less the consequences are, the less we do, the more the consequences are on kind of a sliding scale. And the framework that the scientists set out is, okay, if we do everything right, quote unquote, from, you know, starting right now, the best we're going to do is a total, what they see, anthropogenic climate or temperature increase of 1.5 degrees Celsius. Okay, that's sort of where we stand today, the best case scenario. They say if that happens, and they list what they believe, are their estimates of the consequences. And, you know, it's a total global cost of $50 trillion, which is, you know, an order of magnitude bigger than anybody's used to thinking about. It's, you know, significant droughts that many more people are exposed to, loss of habitat for animals, those sorts of things. And, you know, I don't want to sit here and say, well, how bad are those? They're this bad. But I can generally say they're, you know, things people need to think about. And in fact, if that's the best we can do, we also need to be thinking about how we prepare for that, not just how we stop it, because that can't be stopped. And then they say, okay, well, if instead we let the total increase be 2 degrees. Instead of 1.5 degrees, which is, I believe, what was kind of agreed to in the Paris agreements.
Yeah, yep.
Then, you know, here are the consequences. And it's nothing, you know, they aren't new consequences that aren't the case at 1.5 degrees. They're more serious. It's like 69 trillion instead of 54 trillion or something like that. And it's, you know, more loss of habitat and more heat waves and that type of thing. And then after that, they go on to say, what would it take for it to be 1.5 degrees rather than 2 degrees? Well, they say we can, they basically say we would have to, I wish I remember the quote in the New York Times that kind of summarized, that kind of summed it up that I put in the article, but it was, we basically have to radically change our economic system on a level that we've never seen before. And, and it made it sound even sort of more than a Green New Deal. Although that, you know, probably, it is a big part of what they have in mind. So now we have kind of the costs and benefits of acting, at least at the sort of 1.52 degree level. And of course it could be higher, but the report, I think, unfortunately, doesn't sort of give us those options. And, you know, I think it's an open question for people, but it's a question that needs to be posed for people. I personally don't think to me, the incremental, the extra consequences of 2 rather than 1.5 did not seem to justify, turning our economy and our governmental system into some, you know, radically different thing. I believe me, in general, I love the idea of radically changing our governance system, but probably not in the type of way they're suggesting. And to me, that said, you know, if everybody, so the conclusion of my article wasn't we should do this or we should do that. It was like, let's have a debate where we step away from catastrophe versus hoax.
Right.
And we actually think about what these consequences are and think about what they mean. And sort of the secondary conclusion was, and I think this is what we meant by the inconvenient truth of the Green New Deal. Jeffrey actually wrote that title, so I'll give him credit for that. Even though I mentioned inconvenient truth at the end of it. But basically, we would have, in order to hold the increase at 1.5 degrees, these scientists say we would have to halve our emissions globally, cut by 50% in 12 years. And that just ain't going to happen. And if the proponents of a Green New Deal really think that legislation like that is going to just be passed and implemented such that we can mobilize that in the next decade or so, I don't see what historical precedent they have for that. Except maybe the Great Depression, which was an immediate crisis that people saw right in front of them. I don't think that a democracy can produce those kinds of results, even if one wanted one. So honestly, if you're sitting there advocating for something like a Green New Deal, you're wasting your time vis-a-vis actual, you know, the actual positive impact on the problem you're trying to solve. It's politically infeasible. Even the scientists admit, they say, here's everything we'd have to do, and it's not politically feasible. So it's essentially almost off the table. At the same time, I think that, you know, I hope that if the left would, and I'm probably dreaming already here, kind of let go of the world's going to end unless we do exactly what we say right now. That then maybe some people on the other side of the issue could let go of everything you're saying isn't true. And we could get to this kind of sliding scale and start to really think about it. I'm pessimistic that would happen, but that's, you know, what ideally should happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was really glad that I had dug into it, because again, I knew kind of next to nothing of the details before, and I'm sure in the grand scheme of things, I still know next to nothing, but it really let me kind of try to be objective and take maybe a fresh look at the issue.
Understood. And I think that one of the other arguments that is, I don't even say it's an argument, it's just something I don't think a lot of our progressive friends think about, is what's the best means to accomplish the goal? And this, again, we're kind of starting from where we're picking up where we started, is the best means to address this, to go through legislative channels and enact government policy? Or is it to open up the marketplace to inspire innovation, to inspire alternatives? Because, I mean, let's take, for example, the direst of predictions from the IPCC, right? Which was, I think it was $69 trillion. $69 trillion in the worst case scenario of 2 degrees increased over, I think it was the next 100 years or so, 2 degrees Celsius. So let's say that $69 trillion cost is the worst case scenario. If I'm a business owner and I'm trying to fortify my business and the prospects of my children and my children's children and their children to have successful, fruitful lives, then it would stand to reason that I would want to create an atmosphere, not, and pun intended, I guess, but to create an atmosphere where my company will be able to continue to thrive in that 100-year period. So it would stand to reason that then they would go out of their way to start looking for these alternatives. The problem is that a lot of the alternatives are restricted because of government regulations that, though passed right. with very great intentions, I mean, don't get me wrong, I think that, to quote, paraphrase Milton Friedman, the problem with a lot of government programs is that we look at their intentions rather than their outcomes. That's kind of where we are right now, is that the government regulations that were passed with the idea, or not even necessarily passed, but mandated by, you know, various bureaucratic agencies. They were passed with the idea of trying to do these good environmental or climate initiatives. And in reality, they've actually hurt the very people and the very climate and community that they're trying to help. For example, just let's look at what happened over in California. For all the crap that Trump gets, and trust me, Trump deserves a great deal of it, but he had a very astute point in saying part of the problem with the forest fire over in California was due to the fact that California's regulations about how they deal with their forests created a situation where you have all these dead trees, these dried out dead trees that were just kindling, ready to ignite. And there were articles that were published months in advance from more leftist leaning organizations that were even addressing this. But then as soon as the fires start and Trump says something about it, they dig their heels in, because now Trump has put a position on it and we can't let anything that Trump says be positive in any right. shape or form. So going back to my original point, I think again, if we're trying to find some common ground, which is always the goal of my show, is to find common ground with the folks on the other side of the aisle. I think to your point, it would be good to look again at what the potential negative economic consequences are, number one, but then to say, okay, well then how do we address that now through a more common sense approach? And I think you were very astute in your article, and obviously a very well succinct article that you wrote there can't be addressed in a 30 to 45 minute podcast. But and I'm obviously going to include the link for the folks here in the show to listen or to go back and read, because it is a phenomenal article.
Sure.
But really, the point is we have to have very honest and open conversations with each other instead of digging our heels in to say, how do we approach this? Number one. But number two, what is the end game? What is the goal? Is it to actually inspire new technology that would require the ability to have research and development? Or is it to just enact more government policy that, and this has been, I think, the underlying concern with a lot of folks in the more climate skeptic camp, is that they see this as a means of trying to use government and then use this boogeyman, and I'm using this very loosely, the boogeyman of climate change, to then enact government policies that are going to be more of the quote unquote Marxist policies, right? Where government is going to have its hand in small business, large business, how you're doing, how you're doing your green energy investments. And it's going to cripple these economies. And then they're going to end up using that money for quote unquote social good, social change, instead of actually addressing the real issue. Yeah. I think that's where a lot of the concern and the angst comes from.
Can I just add a couple of things to that?
Absolutely.
I first of all want to make sure that people listening kind of have one thing straight, which is it could be more than 2 degrees, but the scientists, unfortunately, didn't do the same analysis that they did for 1.5 at 2 at 2.5 and 3. And it felt to me like that was a strategic type of thing to sort of foreclose those as acceptable options. And, you know, really, if we're going to talk about this openly, those are the kinds of things we need to know. Once again, at more 30,000 feet, but very much related to what you're saying, I would say that if I have one goal for the rest of my career, in terms of communicating with people about, you know, a whole range of kind of policy issues, it's really to get everybody to step back and kind of kick the tires on the assumption that we all in some ways walk around with, that if there's a problem in society, if there's a problem with the world, the right and really the only way to fix it is the nation state. Is our national governments. And I think that that's obviously something that progressives walk around with. I think that even libertarians or conservatives often, even if they don't realize it, are walking around with it when they do things like oh, that's not that big a, you know, it's, oh, they want to ban public straws where we're going to tell, or plastic straws, sorry, they're going to tell, we're going to tell you how great plastic straws are. Or, this isn't a problem, rather than here are ways other than, our federal government of fixing that problem. Well,
it almost feels like it's this whole mindset of owning the libs. Like a lot of, and I honestly can't say this is all Trump's fault because it's not. Mm-hmm. But the mindset that a lot of people in the more politically right-leaning camp have gotten to as of late has been not a matter of policy or principle, but really a matter of what can we do that will piss off the other side. Yeah. And I think, I mean, I'm not going to try to attack an organization, but like you look at Turning Point USA, and that's mm-hmm. kind of become their shtick. It's like,
right.
How can we own the libs today instead right. of actually saying, well, yeah, plastic straws aren't necessarily a good thing,
right.
but instead of banning straws, let's look for alternatives that are better. Or maybe something that's, you know, biodegradable. I mean, heck, I know metal straws are a big thing that's going on right now. Like, things like that. So there are alternatives. It's just we have to stop getting this mindset of trying to win our... I mean, right. Going back two episodes ago with Mark Claire from Lions of Liberty, we got to stop this mindset of trying to win arguments and actually try to right. win people over to with our positions and our well, it really comes down to win converts, not arguments. Win them with... our ideas and our beliefs, and then put those ideas and beliefs into action instead of just, you know, trying to own the other side.
Mm-hmm. And I think you get kind of getting specifically back to the climate change issue, because this is a great example. You know, it's the fight over government policy is all or nothing, you know, in theory. Either you win and you get everything you want, or you lose and you get nothing you want.
It's
and
zero sum, you know,
I just got done exactly, and I just got done saying that's, you know, it's not realistic that what the left wants here is going to happen. So then you think about, well, what if as individuals, you know, concerned people, and I think people of all persuasions could be interested in this. You know, concerned people along with businesses and governments all started contributing money to, and this is just, you know, an example I'm cooking up, but it's sort of a venture capital type of fund, that is looking for innovative ways to, you know, A, minimize the impact, like you said, but also, prepare us for, you know, what is inevitably going to happen. And I had looked, and like the, you know, venture capital and kind of clean energy technology in that whole sector last year was like $5 billion or something. And that's a fraction of what, people were talking about spending on the Green New Deal. And yeah, you know, if people started doing this privately and voluntarily, that's a non-adversarial, you know, solution. That's somebody's not going to stop you from doing that the way mm-hmm. they're going to try to stop you from the government. And there are, of course, there are problems with that. There's and free riding and right. and whatnot. But I think those are kind of creative solutions that we need to look for. I wrote something a while back about, you know, I said, what if everybody who voted for Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or took the money that they were going to pay extra in taxes under their tax plans relative to Trump's tax plan and just pooled it all together? I'm not saying they should necessarily mm-hmm. pool it all together, but if they did, they would end up with a charity that had a greater annual revenue than the top 50 charities in the U.S. combined.
I love that people don't realize that, you know, when they're like, well, I should pay more in taxes. It's like, you do realize yeah. that the Treasury doesn't have a limit on how much you can give every year, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Well, if I do it and nobody else is, that's not fair. And I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. oh, okay. So you're gonna preach how it's so important for people to give more. And then when you have the chance to voluntarily do it, you're not going to do it because nobody else is doing it. It's like, maybe yeah, your ideas aren't as great as you think they are if they aren't done in a voluntary manner without the use of a government to force people to do something that you want them to do, but they don't want to do.
And we live in this technological network society now where, so this is, you know, in talking again about, you know, does the nation state have to do this? we're now in a place where coordinating that kind of voluntary giving is a lot easier than it used to be. And, you know, it's done every day with kind of GoFundMe campaigns. And personally, I think, you know, a single charity with that much revenue is kind of a scary thing, but it doesn't have to be a single charity, and it doesn't have to and any of that. And, you know, I would love to talk to the left a little bit more about, I think, why some of those voluntary solutions and why some of those more kind of bottom up, non-central government institutions could accomplish the things they want to accomplish that I want to accomplish really a lot better than, their solutions, I think, which would do a lot more collateral damage than they would actually help.
Yep. And, I mean, it's funny because it goes right back to one of your main, focuses is focusing that on people doing cooperative, exchanges, where right. like, for example, like Uber has turned into one of the largest ride sharing organizations, and it didn't exist 10 years ago. And that happened because there was a need in the market. Uber and the founders of Uber found the need, found a way to meet the need, and then they were able to capitalize on it. I mean, that's the way it works. Right. So if there's a need, as much as the people are saying in terms of, you know, the economic climate, or rather the overall climate for the world, then there's going to be someone who's going to see that as a means to capitalize their own answer to the solution or to the problem with their own solution.
Right. And we don't even, even need to, that can be market driven, but also I like to think that in a society where we get used to there being less central government, we have cultural change where a lot of those things can happen kind of from the bottom up, that right now is being crowded out by, by the federal government. I always joke that like everybody hates the word libertarian, and no, I want to be a liberal or I want to be an anarchist. And I say, if I got to pick my own personal term, I would be an anarcho-cooperatarian.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's why I don't do it.
See, I think Dave Rubin's kind of hit the nail on the head in his classical liberal, because it piques the ears of people on the left who identify as a liberal. They're like, a classical liberal? What's that? And it's like, oh, it's what liberals used to be before the left co-opted the word to then fit progressive ideology. That's what it used to be. Yeah. And then they're like, oh, maybe I'm a classical liberal too. And it's like, well, maybe you are. But anyways, I digress. We're coming up to the point in the show where I like to start wrapping things up. Yeah. So with that, to kind of summarize the inconvenient truth to the Green New Deal. Max, if you could give us kind of a little elevator pitch for folks to walk away with. So when they're talking to their coworkers, they're talking to their friends and family about this very, very, very polarizing issue, what can people say to these folks to, number one, articulate the idea in a concise manner, but two, to actually make people think and start to look on their own beyond the talking points that's being promoted by the more alarmist folks on the left?
Right. I would say in all likelihood, the consequences are real and substantial. They are not existential to the point that we have to do everything possible and change everything right now or we're all going to die. That means we can look at the issue like we do any piece of economic policy with costs and benefits. And just secondly, that the sort of massive federal government intervention that people want is probably not even feasible to work in the time frame it would need to work in terms of actually, you know, getting the legislation passed and mobilized. And so it really is a place that's ripe for looking at private and voluntary solutions and innovative ways of doing that.
Awesome. All right, sir. Well, this is the point in the show where I like to do some fun wrap up. So you are an Indianapolis Colts fan. And as a Dallas Cowboys fan, I must say, I hope your team sucks this coming weekend because the Cowboys are playing. We're recording here on December 11th. So just heads up there. But if you could give my audience some fun facts about you, maybe something quirky about you, something that maybe you haven't discussed in other programs that people can get to know you as a person better.
Right. There's a good chance that we'll suck this week. I follow the Colts and I love the Colts. We had, over a decade of Peyton Manning, and it's like when that gets yanked out from underneath you, it's just the exercise becomes a lot sadder. But I'm probably one big walking quirk. I'm an economist with all that implies. I would say my two really kind of biggest passions when I go home, if I'm not with friends or anything like that, I'm generally pacing around my apartment with my headphones on, either listening to music or listening to history podcasts. I have this sort of handicap as academic style researcher that sitting down and reading 1,000-page books often doesn't leave me with a lot I remember. I'm more of an auditory learner. I like people either reading or talking to me. I love learning in general about history. I thought I knew a lot about history from all these podcasts, and then we hired Phil Magnus, who's one of my colleagues, who's a historian, and people either think I'm the funny guy or the guy who knows a lot about things. And with Phil, I'm definitely the funny guy. So.
Awesome. Well, listen, Matt, Max, I really appreciate you taking the time to join the show today. I know you're incredibly busy, Jeffrey Tucker keeps all the folks at AIER very busy.
Let me just say real quick. People ask me what it's like to work with Jeffrey. And, first of all, if you only know him from his writing, he's every bit the kind of unique human being that you would assume he is. But, people think of Jeffrey as this sort of writer and speaker and kind of poet of anarchism. And that's all true. But that's really 10% of what Jeffrey does. He's a manager extraordinaire with social media, with this exciting initiative in book publishing that we have. And along with Ed Stringham, especially in the last year, our work has really paid dividends. And it's, I can't imagine how it could be more exciting here right now.
Jeffrey's a great guy. And I wish you, Chloe, and Jeffrey nothing but the best over at AIER and the rest of the team, obviously. You guys are doing great work over there. So please keep up what you're doing. I know I'm excited to have not only yourself, but Chloe and Jeffrey on again in the near future. So with that, Max, thank you so much again for joining the Brian Nichols Show today. And with that, folks, if you're interested in learning more about Max, you can go over and find him over at AIER. Again, Max Gulker, or you can follow him on Twitter at MaxGAIER. And I'll obviously include the links not only to Max's AIER page, but also the link to the Inconvenient Truth About the Green New Deal article, and Max's his link to his Twitter page. But with that, ladies and gentlemen, if you enjoyed today's episode of The Brian Nichols Show, please take a minute and go ahead and share today's episode with your family and friends. And as always, you can go ahead and follow me on social media at Facebook and on Twitter at BNicholsLiberty. And the way we keep producing this content, guys, that you enjoy is through your help. So Patreon at BNicholsLiberty. And if you want to make a one-time PayPal donation, head over to thebriannicholsshow@gmail.com for that one-time PayPal donation on paypal.com. But as always, folks, it's Brian Nichols signing off here for The Brian Nichols Show with Max Gulker from AIER. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Brian Nichols Show. Find more episodes at briannicholsshow.com.